Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm glad you could join me for a Saturday afternoon with Carolyn Yeager on August 16, 2014. I'm Carolyn. I titled today's program, Why We Lose, only because it popped into my head, and I thought it sounded good. But no, that it's what I want to say, but there are some big questions unresolved in it, like who is we? And I really don't want to go into that. Except just real briefly, if that. But I think I have to a little bit. For me, we are racially aware white people, those who disapprove of race mixing on principle, who love and honor their own people, whichever white people they consider to be their people. So even considering all the white people around the world, this is only a very small minority of all the white people that exist, and the white people are already a minority. So within this, and within this minority, this smaller minority, there is much division and disagreement. But I suppose not on the basic principle, but on how people are going about carrying it out or talking about it. Now, for example, just today, Fritz Berg, who is closely associated with Veronica Clark, sent an email to a few people stating, Frederick Tobin has over the past few weeks made many outrageous claims about me in connection with the IHR struggle against Willis Carto. Tobin has also heaped a great deal of unwarranted praise on Robert Faurisson, in spite of some of the colossal blunders in Faurisson's arguments. Both Faurisson and Carto, a kind of French connection, have in their own peculiar ways done great harm to Holocaust revisionism. Then he says that no doubt Willis Carto would never participate in anything like a debate, certainly not with Fritz Berg, but probably with anybody. And but he says, but Tobin might. He didn't even bring in Faurisson. He wouldn't. And Faurisson is a French speaker, and his English is not, you know, he speaks English and can write in English, but it's, you know, not the easiest thing, I guess, or the most the fastest thing for him to do. So so Fritz is drumming up a debate on somebody's radio program between himself and Fred Tobin, thinking that might undo some of the damage to which Tobin has added. So he says, let's have a debate. Well, Fritz thinks that, of course, there's not going to be one, because I don't think anybody will host it, but Fritz thinks that he's right, and he can push this home if he can just have a chance to air it out and bring it up with Fred Tobin, and to prove that he's right and Tobin is wrong, because he was there at the IHR and Tobin wasn't, so he speaks from firsthand knowledge. Well, you know, in a case like this isn't a small, this is just among a few people, and it's okay if you have disagreements and you want to argue them out. But sometimes it's something that other people think is very minor and is not worth worth worrying over, and doesn't want to make people into enemies with one another. But yet at the same time, I certainly speak out about things I disagree with. So I do think that it's okay to do so. And in this case, I just brought it up because it just came today, and it's an example of how we disagree amongst people who feel the same way. Although amongst all these people, you don't know how much they are what I said, racially aware white people. They are, but in different ways that they would express it in different ways. It appears. Even among these people, what they have in common is Holocaust revisionism, and now that's what's being argued about. But also, who's telling the truth and who isn't? So, in this case, though, you've got one man taking issue with what I would say would be the majority of others, but maybe not, and wanting to insist that he alone is right. So, maybe on Monday I might address some things in the Holocaust revisionist scene. But today I want to emphasize that our most serious error is not in disagreeing among ourselves, but is in feeding the enemy rather than starving the enemy. I'm talking about our participation in the Jewish cultural milieu. It's all around us, so it is not easy to avoid, but the only weapon we have at our disposal is not to participate, to withdraw, to starve the beast, so to speak, with what little influence we have. And by doing that, at least we also won't be continuing to infect ourselves with the poison. Before I go into this more specifically, I want to bring your attention to what we can learn from Dr. Rudolf Frerichs, and this is thanks to Hanning Scott, who has been posting his translations of one of Dr. Frerichs' works on race in the Third Reich on his website, which is national-socialist-worldview.blogspot.com, I do believe. Let me see. I can go here. What am I doing? And, yes, that's it. Okay. So, over the long, he writes in part five, which is at the top of the site now, about the history of racial. Now I have to go look again for the title of this. The racial policy of National Socialism. Okay, remember this is part five, so he's already covered a lot of territory. And I really like this Dr. Frerichs work, and I must like the way Hanning has translated it, because I think it just comes across very clear, very well, and in a way that I can certainly agree with everything he's saying. I think I do. So over the long term in history, he writes, a people can only be powerful and significant if it is large and rich in numbers. It sinks into insignificance if this declines. Not, however, number alone, but first the quality and competence of a people's particular hereditary lineages condition the level of its culture. So he says that you have to have large enough numbers to even be significant in your influence, which is true. But he says even before this, the first thing is the quality and competence of the hereditary lineages. That is what's often called the racial line or the blood of the people. So he's saying here that some people's competence hereditarily is better than others. Or otherwise there wouldn't be any distinction here. I would say Africans are a good example. Africans exist in large numbers all over the planet, but mostly in Africa, of course, but elsewhere too. The quality and competence of their hereditary line is low. So they don't have significance. They're not powerful in the world in spite of their numbers. So you therefore, obviously, if you have this quality in your people, you can exert a certain amount of power without such great numbers. But of course, you can't do it if you have such small numbers. That wipes it out. So he goes on to say, if a people's hereditarily competent lineages are degraded through faulty selection, its cultural achievements change accordingly. Well, he's saying right here that that your achievement, the achievement of a people, is dependent on their heredity, their racial line. I'll just put it that way. So he says then the character of a people, however, is conditioned by the purity of its blood. So he's just saying that again, that that if you're if you degrade your heredity through faulty selection of partners, and boy, that's a big problem today, then you affect the purity of the blood. And if this becomes mixed, then its expression, its innermost life, also changes. So when people become mixed, they might appear pretty much the same, but he's saying that the way they express themselves as a people changes. And the people become uncertain, even when faced with the most important questions of its existence, the people's existence. And I have been saying for some time, alluding to this, that if there's too much ethnic mixture, not even racial mixture, but just too much ethnic mixture, it's not a good thing for people, because they're not sure who they are or where they stand or where they belong. And that's then is, brings on an uncertainty when you have to answer important questions of existence, because your own existence is too mixed to for you to stand with one on one side of the or embrace one thing, because you see things from too many perspectives, from too many sides. I would give some examples of this, but I don't want to start speaking about people right away and offending anybody. So I already do enough offending. So I'll just say about this, then how do we stand in regard to these questions affecting the life of a people? Are we too far gone, already on the way downward to our demise? Is our numbers declining? Are the competent dying out? Are the inferior increasing? I'd have to say yes to all that. I don't know, what would you say? Our numbers are declining, both in the total number of white people, but also in what I said is the racially conscious white people. Those who are aware of being white and wanting to protect and defend the whites in this world, and protect and defend our cultures from this takeover of others who are not us. Now, how do we stand regarding the maintenance of the purity of our blood? Another question. Well, let's investigate these questions in sequence. How do we stand today? Is our number declining? Yes. It is. Are the competent dying out? Well, I think so. I wouldn't mind hearing from people who think they want to, think that's all wet later on in the second hour, especially, and that would be the best time. If you want to call this program in the second hour at 323-642-1206, but in my opinion, we are becoming less competent. All we have to do is look back not so far and see what people were able to do and that what we are not able to do. Times have changed, yes, but we are losing. We're not the people that once existed in our name, that we take the name of. And are the inferior increasing? Well, that goes along with the competent dying out. Naturally, they're going to increase. How do we stand regarding the maintenance of the purity of our blood? Well, what is being pushed, you know, is to make fun of the purity of our blood. And, you know, it's hard to even say those words because it sounds kind of odd today to talk about the purity of blood because it's been denounced so much. It's been made out to be foolish and the thinking of people who are just racist and hateful and so on, who shouldn't even be listened to. So if you talk about that, it's difficult in itself. And what's being pushed by more and more people is that it's all about spiritual values and character, etc. And they don't worry so much about race, and they tell us not to worry about race. And I'm not speaking just about one person, say, Veronica Clark. I'm speaking about a lot of people that I see on the Internet writing and posting things, and also in comment sections. You hear that a lot in comment sections because comment sections are filled with people to give that point of view, and filled with mixed race people who don't say they are and who you don't know who they are because we have all this anonymity in these names that don't give you any idea whatsoever who the person is. You shouldn't even be reading it. I don't take that material seriously. I'm just saying that I see it. I see it a lot. And a lot of people are uncomfortable, as I already said, to stand up for any kind of idea of race or pure race or even the word blood. They would rather, they feel more comfortable saying, well, you know, we need to accept all people who have good character and who believe the way we do and so on. Well, how do you know that they do? What Frex is saying is that it is in the heredity and it's passed down hereditarily, and it's not something that people who don't have that in their hereditary line will have, even if they might make a good try for it. But when, I guess you could say, when push comes to shove, they are the ones who would most likely cave in. But as again, there's always exceptions. There's always exceptions, but we can't go by the exceptions. So all of these questions have the yes answer to them, it seems. this brings another answer, which is to not participate in the Jewish culture, which is where we're stuck. And I think when you look at solutions, we don't have any real good solutions except that one, to drop out, as you say, to refuse to participate in Jewish culture, to all the way, you know, not just a little bit of it, but all the way. Because this is the problem. We're in a Jewish culture, and we're getting more and more happy with it and more used to it. And if people, I'm going to list some things here in a minute. A lot of these things in this culture, if they were taken away from many of us, we would just be absolutely brought down by it. We would be going berserk. We'd be in such deep, terrible withdrawal. We wouldn't be able to hardly tolerate it. So, you know, but what when we look at today people look at, there are a lot of people who are racially conscious people, whites, who look at Hitler's Third Reich. And that looks so beautiful to us today. And we obviously are not able to carry on with something like that. We're not able to create something like that ourselves. I know the times are different, but we're not able to start something and keep it going and have enough strength in it, because everything with us is constant bickering. But it's not just that, because there is bickering there, but we don't have the big idea, but we also don't hold to the racial idea that they did. You see, they first took care of the racial idea, and that's why I started out with Dr. Freck's statement there. They took care of that, and when they were building their party and their nation, they had an anti-Semitic policy all the way. And today, half have that and half don't have that. Even amongst the most racially aware and concerned white, pro-white people. So I would say that what in answer to not participating in this Jewish culture, we have to start our own things. Some people try to. They're not all that popular. They're not popular enough. I want to have a revisionist institute that's not run into the ground by the Jew-infected Mark Weber. And think of David Cole in relationship to that. Why is David Cole Mark Weber's favorite revisionist and vice versa? David Cole was very, very welcome, and he says he's known Mark Weber all these years, and they're such good friends, and he has so much high regard for him. But going back to the email from Berg earlier, the dispute at the IHR, which I spoke about just last week, or the last time I was on, as important as it seemed to those people at the time, it would have been better if everybody had just accepted what was happening, accepted Carto's leadership, and let it go. And then Mark Weber would not have become director of the Institute, and everybody else wouldn't have quit. Or if they had quit, it would have stayed in Carto's hands, and he would have done something with it better. I'm just speculating here, you know, just what it would look like. Better than what has happened, because what has happened has been a disaster. Because Fred Tobin is right that we should have, and we could have had, a strong revisionist institute still today. But we can't seem to get one going again. I would like to get one going, but it's very difficult because most of us are old, and it takes you have to have somebody young to carry it on into the future. You can't start something with old people and there's no young people there to continue with it. And the young people, except for a few, don't have some of the qualities that the older generation had. So you don't see, they have a different perspective on what needs to be done. I don't know that it's fully capable of really bringing down the Holocaust hoax. So there again, it takes a lot of people getting together, and in order to do that, people have to give up other things they're doing and just focus on that, and that's not easy to do. So we don't have something like they had in National Socialist Germany, where this idea, so many talented people were drawn to this idea, and they accepted this strong leader, and they went forward until they accomplished what they were out to accomplish. And they still inspire us today. But some of these examples of of the beast that we are feeding, that I'd like to bring up and speak about a little bit today, are the number one, might not be the worst thing there is, but it certainly is number one on my list, Facebook. It's a totally Jewish operation. It was invented It was created by a Jew who's now a multi-billionaire, I guess. Young guy, too. And yet, how people can't resist going and getting a Facebook page. That's why he's so rich. That's why it's so successful. And what has it accomplished? Well, people, I guess, since I'm not never been on it, I guess it's easy, you know, and it's free. You can get a Facebook page. It's got all this way how you can, you know, put stuff on it, and you can have people post on it and keep people away that you don't like and allow people in. You can hide things you don't want everybody to see. There's a lot of ways to make it work for you and to draw people to read what you have to say and to maybe congregate and make friends based around what you believe in. For people like us, for most people, it's just a way of just having something on the internet that's all there, already there for them. And as I said, it's free, and they can play around with it, you know, and have fun with it. It's just fun and family stuff and so on. And so it's going to be successful anyway. But what about white racially conscious people? Why should they be using that Facebook for their purposes? Because what they're doing as they do it, even if they say, and this is such a famous old saying, well, other people are going to be doing it. If I'm on it or I'm not on it, it's not going to make any difference. Well, it makes a difference to you, and the only difference you can make is what you do, is what you can do. And if none of our people were on Facebook, maybe we would start our own type of thing that would be for us rather than a universalist thing. And then after Facebook is YouTube. And I know all the value that YouTube has brought and all the opportunities it's given to people. But there's a Mike Delaney went to all the trouble and all the work and still does to keep it operating to create TrueTube. And I don't use either one, so once again, I don't have firsthand knowledge. And I know that a lot of people do use TrueTube and it's pretty popular. But I'm not a big video person, so. If people who use TrueTube only use TrueTube and not YouTube, then TrueTube would be even more important, and people would have to go there for to see the kind of things that these people were making and posting, our people, and that would strengthen it, and that would once again give us something of our own, and we would no longer be using the other one. It's like opting out of your culture, but when the culture is totally run by Jewish interests, then it seems, even though you would have less people that you could reach and so on, it would still be better for us in the long run. Then a third one, I'm not sure if Twitter is a problem. Twitter is not as much Jewish, but they're one of the four main founders was a Jew. The other three don't seem to be, but that's just another one of these cultural things that gets people to communicate a lot of pointless nonsense rather than spend their time more seriously, and gets a lot of attention. And as some people have said, brings in short-term thinking and the idea that for a lot of people, they can't do more than, and a lot of white people, they can't do more than write a few words or a sentence. That's about the extent of their ability in writing. And that only encourages it. Well, to get out of these social medium here, I also add the stock exchanges. That's another absolutely Jewish It's not a Jewish invention because there were stock exchanges going pretty far back, but it has been taken over by Jewish finance, and the whole stock exchange changes today take their cue from what the Federal Reserve does. That's all you hear on there if you listen to what they're saying, is or read what people who are right about these things say. They can't ever stop talking about the Federal Reserve. The Fed is in always the topic. What's the Fed doing? The Fed is all Jewish. This is talking about the United States Federal Reserve, which in a sense controls all the others. When you use that, you're at the mercy of this whole system. Plus, the stock exchanges have become, especially the New York one, has become such a gambling casino. I mean, it's all speculation. Once the Jews got stronger and stronger in that, it allowed all this speculation, so that people who would like to invest through the public companies process are really at the mercy of all kinds of swings and so on because of the speculative element that dominates in the stock exchanges. So it's better for our kind of people to also stay out of that. And the best way to invest money is to invest in property and land. Of course, you have to be there and you have to be responsible for it. A lot of people don't want that, and that's why the stocks and bonds I can't even think of the name of it. Now you buy shares in a certain plan, you know, that's... my God, just a simple word, but they invest that way, because then they're free. They don't own anything. They don't have to take care of property, but white people are giving up property, as we learned, you know, in the Third Reich gives us lessons about that too, when the Jews were managing to take over property that was in German families for centuries, and buy them out because of the bad times that had come on during the Weimar period. And the National Socialists put a stop to that with some laws about not being able to sell your property that you had inherited. They had a lot of obstacles up for it. So, and who could inherit it and so on, so that it would most likely stay in the family of these German people, and they wouldn't be so tempted to say, well, I just want to get my money out of this. I don't want to take care of this anymore. and then you sell out to always to Jews. So we should also be encouraging, by staying out of the stock exchange, and if you have money and you're making money, and you should invest it in property and things that will bring more value to white people, more valuable holdings in the hands of white people, rather than have it all in the hands of non-white people or of others, and not having a solid hold on your own country, you know, on the property and land and so on of your own country. Now, of course, we can't forget Hollywood. Hollywood is another big one. And even television has to be included in that. In that, if we opted out of watching any Hollywood movies, which is just a basic thing that should be done. But people won't even do that. Our people won't do that because they want to watch them and see, and then they think they're criticizing them, they're being critical, and that's important. But you know, they don't. I say we don't need to see any of it. I never see a movie, and I never watch television either. And I don't need to see what they're doing firsthand. I could read about it in a real quick by just seeing that all this new TV show is here, and here's who's in it, and look at it's so funny, and you know, they give a little bit about it. You know all you need to know about it just from that. You can tell what's going on in that. You don't need to sit and watch it. And that is real poison, Hollywood movies and television, and also the celebrities, the whole celebrity culture that goes along with it. There's always been a desire in people to see films and to, you know, kind of idolize the glamorous stars that are in there, and people that in common people have been idolizing famous and beautiful people for a long time. I suppose it goes back even like into the time of the pharaohs, when these great elite leaders of these empires were presented as super, you know, as all in fancy costumes and clothing and all, with all sorts of entourages, and very wealthy and powerful, and as gods in some cases. And these were celebrities back then. And the people, you know, fell for it and liked it, and the people couldn't resist it even then. So that's something in human nature to that could be examined more as to what that's more healthy could take the place of that, I guess. Because even in National Socialist Germany, Hitler kind of turned into a celebrity and an icon, and they put on pretty big, you know, some shows and pageantry for the people, because people do respond to that. But it wasn't like Hollywood and our television. It was so much more it was promoting the good of the nation and the people. So lastly, the one I thought of is Major League Sports. That is also one that has become controlled by Jews, and that people spend an inordinate amount of time following and caring about, and following the participants that are in there. Of course, the ideal would be for racially conscious white people to form their own sporting leagues and participate in them. They wouldn't have to be on television, you know, to in their communities, and not follow this international sports. Because all of this makes the Jews rich. It feeds not just Jews, but it feeds the globalist multicultural worldview. And so, if this was taken away all at once from most, even the most racially aware whites who still use these things, they would be basket cases. They would go berserk for a while. They would certainly regress back to their old habits in short time, because they wouldn't be able to stand being without them. I can imagine people not being able to give up their Facebook page. And more people get one because they think everybody else has one. So that means to me that we are weak and they are strong. We can't keep talking about how strong we are if we're not demonstrating it. If we can't have our own culture, if we have totally been pulled into this, what so many call Jewish culture. It's not just Jews creating it, but it's still a Jewish, it's a proper definition to call it a Jewish culture. Then we're not able to resist that. So they're winning, we're losing. And I already pointed out that in National Socialist Germany, they created their own culture there without Jews. They were talented and capable enough to do it. That's the bottom line there. In Germany, they had the talent and the capability to create their own culture. And they first went to their old original culture. And they were researching into their folk days and into the German past and so on, into their ancestors. And they built on that. I think this is very, very important. It's important because not all white societies are capable of doing this but all would be capable to some degree to doing it. What it is that the people want the other stuff. They like, you have to admit, we like Jewish culture. We like it. This is why we're losing, because we like what they offer. And we don't want to do, once we get a taste of it, we don't want to give it up. You can say, oh, gee, that's an addiction. They're addicting us. Well, they might be addicting us, but everybody's responsible for overcoming the addictions that they've succumbed to and not being addicted. It's not easy. It's a struggle. If you give in to every enjoyable thing that comes along, well, you're going to be in bad shape pretty soon. So you have to resist. You have to fight against it. And by fighting, I mean, you have to fight in your own self. But once the anti-Semitic point of view was able to be put in place altogether, they didn't have, and in Germany, they didn't have any Jews among them. And the Jews that were there were quiet because they had been subdued by having their power removed by the laws. And so the fact that there were still quite a few Jews, but not quite a few in comparison to the number of the German population, not at all. But there were still some Jews, but these Jews were not very capable of doing much damage because they were more isolated and they were not didn't have the opportunity like they had before. Excuse me. So this has all been said before. It's all pretty familiar to people, but you know, it's still what works. It's still the answer. There is no other answer than this. What we have to do, what anybody has to do, is withdraw from the poison and get used to it and look for ways to create something that is authentic to ourselves. So I'll hope to have some more ideas about this eventually, but right now I'm going to leave that where it is, and I'm going to move on to to this event that National Policy Institute is planning for October. And I saw this ad by the Future of Europe, a conference in Budapest, Hungary, 3rd and 4th of October. And it has four names on it, four gentlemen. Alexander Dugin is first, Richard Spencer is second, Jared Taylor, and Marcus Willinger. And it says, that's it. And it's been there on Occidental Observer for quite a while, in where they, that one space after the first part of the lead article on the front page, they have that one space there for an ad. And it's often something from Richard Spencer. And I thought, well, what the heck, you know, this doesn't look good. What are they doing? But, you know, I've never been too interested in Richard Spencer. And he's somebody that if it comes up, I think, well, I have enough issues that I'm dealing with, and I have enough people that I'm arguing with, so I'm not going to add Richard Spencer to my list, so I just ignore it and pass it by. But then, just the other day, I was looking at DestroyZionism.com, and I saw that they had a post on it, and they call it A Note on Alexander Dugin, and it has this copy of this poster that's at Occidental Observer that I just described to you. And they are objecting to this. And they said that, you know, they're objecting to the fact that this, what they call the Putinist pseudo-philosopher Alexander Dugin will speak at this meeting. So I read what they wrote, and I found it to be a very good post and very interesting. I might just read it, and then I'll go on over to the National Policy Institute and talk about how this meeting is described there. Destroy Zionism, and this is everything there is under the name of Stryker's Ghost. He just writes these posts. He's an anonymous person, supposedly from Sweden. That's what I've heard. And therefore, he comes out pretty strong on here, so he doesn't want to be, since it's on the internet, I guess he could get in trouble in Sweden and elsewhere in Europe, so he doesn't give his name. But he says a possible reason for this meeting with Dugin is that Spencer is married to Nina Kuprianova, also known as Nina Byzantina, who has translated Dugin's works into English. By the way, Richard Spencer is a white nationalist who has been around for a long time. He's been associated with people like Kevin MacDonald and Jared Taylor and Greg, you know, I'm having trouble with people's names, at Countercurrents, now I can't even think of Greg's last name. Oh, Johnson, Greg Johnson, and others, a lot of these people. He's had some, he might have been involved with TOQ, but he's had some websites, and he's friends with a lot of people. He never appealed to me, but that's because he's an Nietzschean, he says. But just to give you some, right now, his website is the National Policy Institute, NPLAmerica.org, and he's there. They're actually trying to be a political force in the United States, it appears. You know, talking about what goes on in Congress and lobbying Congress and so on. So this Destroy Zionism post goes on to say that Spencer's wife, Byzantina, spends much of her time on Twitter defending Vladimir Putin and the Soviet Union. Some of this is picked up that I saw after I read this, and I was looking into it from the Daily Caller, from an article they had there. And they might identify that here, they might not. I didn't see it, but in the past, Destroy Zionism has been anti-Putin. That's why they talk like this here. And she says that he says that Spencer's wife goes so far on Twitter as to claim that Stalin was not a mass murderer. Interesting to note here is that Stalin was a Georgian, not an ethnic Russian, and Byzantina practically brags about her Georgian ancestors. Georgians are a mongrel Eurasian people, according to this. Why is this important anyway? Because Alexander Dugin is most certainly not a supporter of white racialism or even of European civilization. He believes in Russia as a Eurasian power. Dugin's Russia is a multiracial and non-racialist state outside of European civilization, allied with non-European powers against the West. And it is amazing how many Westerners Americans and Europeans today are backing Putin against the West and even accepting Dugin because of it, because they're so anti-West, because they see the West as having been taken over by Jews, and therefore, in order to get to defeat the Jews, they imagine that Vladimir Putin has a plan to do that, because otherwise, why would they do it? Why would they think this way? They're not thinking very far. They're not good thinkers. They're not deep thinkers. They're simplistic-minded. And again, I think jumping on the bandwagon for the most part. Anyway, this blog post goes on to say, I thought the most interesting sentence of all, was it is not only the liberalism infecting the West that Dugin objects to, but to the West itself as a civilization. And I have read plenty of things by him in which he does say that. He does talk like that. He's very anti-West and demeans it as like its whole history, you know, and he's very pro-East, and he is positioning Russia with the East against the West. And all these Westerners, I guess with our death wish or something, are, as I said, supporting that. Now, it goes on to say, furthermore, Dugin, in an article titled Isaac, Luria, and Sabbatai Zevi in Russian Orthodoxy, writes that, and here's a Dugin quote, I was already reading the precious books of Gershom Scholem, whom I consider to be the greatest traditionalist thinker, unquote. And the post says, the Jewish writer Hannah Arendt remarked regarding Scholem, who was a Jewish Kabbalist, and she said, basically, Scholem believes the midpoint of the world is Israel. So the people who write this stuff are the ones who Dugin is praising, and at the same time, Dugin himself and sometimes and other people will say, "Oh, he doesn't like the Jews. No, he's not this and he's not that." And yet it comes out of his own mouth, and that again, I'm going to be talking about Veronica Clark again in a little bit, and that again is well, I better take a look at my. Okay, that again is the way she talks. She says things, and she says, "Oh, I'm not saying that. I don't really mean that. If you really listen to me, you're twisting my words." You know, that's the same kind of thing. And this is one thing that's kind of rampant in our ranks today, is that we are embracing people. And a big point of this program today is that we are embracing people, along with embracing this Jew culture of ours, that are not good for us and that are not on our side either. But we think, here comes in the Jew culture of the West that I was just pointing out all that's wrong with it, but we think that since that's wrong, we'll embrace somebody else's culture. And that'll be better. Like, you have to do one or the other. You can't create your own, which is what I was not very smooth way, but I was trying to give some examples or some reasons why this is the only way out for us, that we have to get back to our own culture and figure out what that is. We can't keep joining up with other people's cultures. That's why we're disappearing. You know, that's so weak. Now, furthermore about this Dugin, here's a few quotes from the translation of an interview in Der Spiegel by this Dugin. The Western civilization is a racist, ethnocentric civilization. See, racism is bad to him and to Putin. Every Westerner is a racist, he says. This is like saying every white person is a racist, that the Negroes say. Every Westerner is a racist. But my opinion is the civilizations of the West and the East are completely different. The Eastern one is superior in respect to defending herself against the Western racism. Well, there's a lot of people that I, on websites that I see, who will agree, who will say the Eastern is superior to the Western in a way, but they won't say that it's because of Western racism. But he says it's because of Western racism. The Western European ethnocentrism is a constant. It's against ethnocentrism. All European philosophers are racist. Now, these sentences are separated, so he didn't say this all in one line here, and I don't have the whole context, but these are things that he said. And he then said, we Russians are no nationalists. We never were a nation. When we speak of the ours, it isn't meant ethnic. The Chechen or the Uzbek are also included. So that's his. He's speaking as a high-level Russian. Then on, he speaks of Eurasia. He says, Eurasia, that's Russian. That's Russia and her partners, Turkey, Iran, China, India, the post-Soviet space, which even includes Mongolia. So Russia and her partners, all these non-white countries. And then Spiegel says, you say there are no critics of the Putinistic course anymore. And if there are critics, they are mentally ill, and they must be sent in the control of doctors. Putin is everything. Putin is indispensable. Is that really by you? And Dugin answers, yes. But here at Destroy Zionism, they conclude that Putin is clearly anti-European and anti-white, and he doesn't belong in a white racialist meeting. They say, tragically, the otherwise admirable site, the Occidental Observer, has chosen to promote this NPI event. Well, so what is this meeting? Let's see here. What is this meeting? It's called The Future of Europe and Perspectives on Geopolitics, Identity, and Nationalism in Budapest, Hungary. You know what this meeting is, really? It's that this Spencer has this organization, the National Policy Institute, and it gives, when you have things like this, it's obviously nonprofit, and you can write off a lot of things. So he'd like to do some traveling, and he'd like to visit with certain people and, you know, network a bit and all that. So when you have something like this, the same way that Mark Weber does it, or used to do it, still tries to do it just a little bit with the IHR, create an event, and you can take it all off your taxes, whatever, or your, if you're nonprofit, you can take it, you can put it in the way of expenses, and you can make a little money off of it, or you can at least travel for free, and you have a reason for it. So then he advertises, he gets his friends to say they'll come and speak, and then they advertise it, and there's always enough people. It doesn't take a whole lot. I guess they're not, you know, trying to have crowds, but there's some people who will sign up for it, who have the money, who want to meet with these people, who, you know, who wouldn't mind going and seeing Budapest, and at the same time meet all these white nationalist types. And of course, Alexander Dugin is a big draw because he's so exotic right now and so much in the news. And so people would, these people would like to meet him and say, oh, I met Alexander Dugin, go there. And so who are, when you go to this website, when you go to the event as it's advertised on this, or explained on the website, npiamerica.org, a few pictures come up. Starts with the picture of Alexander Dugin. He's the star speaker. And then it goes to Tom Sunich. Boy, if we haven't heard Tom Sunich enough times already with not much to say and think he's going to be a draw, but I guess they think he is, or they promise and they feature him. But after Tom Sunich is Jared Taylor. Of course, we hear from Jared Taylor all the time, too, so that's not such a draw, but these are the people who were willing to come and speak. And they probably feel they get something out of it, or maybe at least a trip to Budapest. And then after that is Richard Spencer. So those are the only pictures. But the names that are featured, one is very interesting to me, and that is Manuel Ochsenreiter. Ochsenreiter, who's German, and he is the editor of Zurst magazine, which is a right-wing magazine, not just a conservative magazine. It's an actual right-wing magazine that has kept going. It's got some financing. I remember when it first came out because Willie Chrisman told me about it, and he got a subscription, and he was happy about it and liked it. It had some pretty good articles. I haven't seen it for ages, but this guy would be interesting. So they got him. The rest of them are not so interesting. But okay, I'll read them. Alexander Dugin, Martin Jongjozi, that must be a Hungarian, John Morgan, Manuel Ochsenreiter, Richard Spencer, Tomislav Sunich, Jared Taylor, Philippe Bardon, I don't know him, and Marcus Willinger. I think I tried looking him up, but I didn't find anything, so... Some people know him, but he's not real well known. Anyway, so I'm not going to spend too much more time on this because the schedule, October 3rd, evening cocktails and hors d'oeuvres. Then October 4th, you have the main day, the speakers and everything. They call it the European Congress. Then the next, that's Saturday. This is Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Then the next day, Sunday is just the day where they kind of pawn you off. You can do some things take a tour. You can take your choice of two tours of Budapest, and then have lunch. So the main registration for the event is $150. But if you wait until September 15th, after that it's $170. Then they have a lower price. This includes a lunch, coffee, and a dinner. But I don't know how good they are because it's not that much more than the basic one, which doesn't include the meals, which is $125. And then after September 15th, it's $145. But if you're young, under 30, or a full-time student, you can get in for $50. And so they're wanting people to register for this. And then on Sunday, you can, if you want to hang around, and you can do a walking tour of Budapest and have a group lunch, which costs you $26. The walking tour is $46. No, that's for the cheap one. Then if you take the three-course traditional Hungarian meal with the others, and then including the walking tour, it's $46. Something like that. And you have your choice of two tours. The tourism industry gets in on these things. So all you have to do is contact some of these tourist places, and you say, tourist agents, and you say, well, I have this organization, and I'd like to set up a meeting for for us in such and such a location, and we'll need some meeting space, and we'll need some hotel rooms reserved so that they can, they can reserve these rooms, but some hotel rooms available, and tour guides to take them on a tour on the Sunday, and we need some meals, and then they set this stuff all up for you, because tourism is a big industry, and there's plenty of help for you to do this, and it doesn't cost you or your organization anything, but you get to go there, he gets to go, and these few other people like Jared Taylor gets to go. And probably won't cost him anything because he's willing to speak, and the others, and they can meet with Alexander Dugan, and they can bring attention to their organization. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but it's kind of people like to go. They want to meet these people. There are people who they want to meet Tom Sunick. They'd like to meet this Manuel Oxenreicher, but they're gonna be available to you, but only in a superficial kind of a way. And you meet a few other people, and you have a little bit of a vacation, and it's not that expensive at all. Of course, this doesn't include your flight over there. Obviously that's not even mentioned. You have to be there. You have to get there to Budapest for that weekend, and then that's up to you. And they have some lodging rates from 108 euros a night to 122 euros a night, so that you can take advantage of if you want to. And that's it. So, but the whole point remains is that why do they want to have Alexander Dugan? Well, I think because he's a big draw, because he's famous, and because Spencer's wife has been translating his books, so she has been in touch with him, and she's Russian and can speak Russian, so she was able to set this up with them, and this is what it turns out. What they're going to be saying, I don't know, probably nothing. I mean, Dugan's going to be saying what he says, how that's going to fit into the future of Europe, perspectives on geopolitics, identity, and nationalism. That's just vague. I mean, some people will be talking about one thing, some people will be talking about something else. But this is where I think it's an example of where we cross the lines just because we want to get along with people or because we want to do things. And obviously, this National Policy Institute doesn't have any, supposed to be speaking up for white people, our people, for our people, our culture, our future. But why would they want to be promoting an anti-racist like Alexander Dugan? And that's what he is. So again, there's this stress put on racism. There's this blot put on racism. There's white people supposedly serving white people, racially conscious people, who don't want to be racist. They don't. And they don't want to be called racist, and they don't consider themselves racist. And they're not even Holocaust revisionists, these people. Not really. and they're not going to talk about that either. And they're not pro-National Socialist Germany. What are they? They're a weak group of people. You know, going back to talking about being strong and being weak, and are we winning or are we losing? Well, this is why we lose, because we don't have any really strong people. And those who talk tough tend to be kind of crude and not all that intelligent either, and certainly don't put on a good appearance, so many of them. So we're kind of in a vacuum, we're in a power vacuum. It's hard to identify who's really doing something for us. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to move on to something a little more, I'm going to start out with something a little personal, but and if at this point you want to call this show, you're welcome to do so. I'll repeat the number. It's 323-642-1206. I've got my studio page up again, so I'll be able to see it. Yesterday, you know, I posted the Platterhoff speech that was supplied to me by Wilf Hynek quite a long time ago, because he had it. He's the translator of it. I've been a little bit of a, that's been disputed by Veronica Clark that I had any, that I needed to take that down because she's got that all copyrighted. So I just took it off the front page, you know, off the blog, but it was still there. And then she was talking about doing this DMCA against me, which stands for Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And so yesterday she succeeded, and yesterday I got a, I didn't worry about it, and it's no big deal, but I got a notice or an email from my server host that they had received this, and I got a copy of it, the complaint, the DMCA complaint, and they said I needed to remove that within 24 hours or they would have to suspend my account. Well, the thing to understand about this is that these server hosts, at least mine, and maybe all of them are not as bad as, or some of them are might stand up for you a little bit, but mostly they don't. They just rent you the server. You know, I think that I own my server, but I don't. They own it. And I just pay for it every month, and so I rent it, you know, and they could actually kick me off of it if they want to. And they have done that to people. So, and they don't care about who's right and who's wrong, and they're not going to do any legal work for me or anybody. When they get something like that, they simply enforce it, you know. They simply say, okay, we got this complaint against you, so you need to comply with what's being asked. And but the thing is, if you want to contest it, you have to. And if you don't take that stuff down, and you want to contest it, they're still going to temporarily suspend your account so that my site would go down. See, there's no way to keep my site up unless I take them off. So I took them off because it's no big deal. I certainly do not want my site to go down. That's much more important. This is only just two posts, which aren't necessary for my site. But I did think, I did feel that I had a right to them, I did feel like I had a right to have them posted there, but this is why I'm going to go through something here a little bit, which also is interesting about this ongoing, well, dispute with Veronica Clark that so many people have. She has her her supporters, but so many people are realizing what this woman is up to. And so this is this sheds some light on this entire matter. And if you go to Hitler's most significant speech, which I'm going to have to do so I can read something off of there. So I'm not going to be able to, unless I juggle a bunch of stuff around here. I don't know if I can. Let's see here. Let's see how this works. No, because it's on the same, it won't go on to a different page. It won't work. So anyway, I'm not looking at my phone calls right now, ladies and gentlemen. Well, I don't need to do this right this minute. Okay. If you go to Hitler's most significant speech, on Amazon.com. It says, in describing the book, it says, the importance of an event or an occasion is how worthwhile it is in the scheme of things. The significance of an event... No, it doesn't say that. It says, only 100 copies printed in December 2010. So this book was published in December 2010, and she only had 100 copies printed. Why? Because she wanted to make it a collector's item, I think, or she thought nobody would buy it, but I think it's because she wanted to make it a collector's item. And when those 100 copies were gone, no more were printed. Now I want to read something from there. And that is that it says inside the cover of this book that the book has been copyrighted at two dates, 2009-2010, to Veronica Clark. And then it says it was translated by Wilfred Hank. So he translated it. But she has the copyright on it. I don't know what she has the copyright on. She says she has the copyright on the speech translation that was translated by Wilfred Hank. And he doesn't, obviously she didn't ask him, but he doesn't care. See, he doesn't care what was done with it. And then she says, I want to thank, down below she says, I want to thank Wilf, Hans, Johannes, Gunther, Scott, Fritz, and my mom for their assistance with this project. Without all of you, this book would not have been possible. Thank you! With an exclamation mark. So she's thanking all these people who helped her out, but she didn't give anything to them. And she starts out with Wilf. And Hans must be Hans Krampe. I don't know who Johannes and Gunther and Scott are, but Fritz would be Friedrich Berg. And so there you go. That's who helped her with this book. And her mom probably paid for it or something, paid some of her expenses. And but then what's so interesting, then there's a translator's note. And this translator's note is by Friedrich Berg. And it was written, it says so. You know, he signed it, and it's written, dated March 11, 2009. So the book came out in December 2010. So almost 2 years before that. Not 2 years, but let's say 1 year and 8 months or 9 months, depending. The writing of this little phrase, this little several paragraphs here, and the publication of the book. And then underneath that, I'm going to wait to read that. Then underneath that, she writes, Veronica Clark writes, see, is her name on there? Well, it has to be her. She's the author. She says, given that this speech was apparently stenographically recorded, has several illegible parts, and reads somewhat erratically, it was difficult to translate it into English without some degree of modification in sentence structure and word order. However, the reader ought to know that word order and sentence structure is different in German than in English, and what is oftentimes permissible in German, grammatically speaking, is not permissible in English. Well, she's making a big deal out of something that's very basic, that if you have any degree of knowledge of English and German, you know that. It's not a big deal to change the sentence structure around. It doesn't change anything. I've done it many times, working with Wilhelm Christman, in that, you know, he leaves some of that German sentence structure there, and I changed it. At first I was leaving it, and then I realized that's not the way you do it. You're supposed to change it just so it reads better in English. She's admitting here that it was there were several illegible parts, and Will Pike told me that some of these illegible parts were not just a few words. They were entire sentences. They were whole lines and several lines that because it had been folded and so on, things had part of the type had disappeared. And then she says that it reads erratically. Well, it read the way the stenographer took down what Hitler said. But she thought that didn't come across the way she wanted it to, you know, because she wanted to have it be very smooth and smooth English. And so she says, as such, Wilf and I put our best combined effort to avoid distorting or changing the original meaning of what Hitler said. We also tried to avoid altering Hitler's original intent. Aha, well, of course they would. Of course they would. They tried. Of course they should have avoided altering Hitler's original intent. She seems to think that there's difficulty in avoiding this. They had to put forth their best combined effort to avoid distorting or changing the original meaning of what Hitler said. I find that very strange, unless it's written so badly that you can't even make it out, unless the German is so poor that it doesn't make sense or something like that. But she doesn't want to say that. So she says, we put forth our best effort to capture Hitler's humor, cynicism, sarcasm, and the nuances of his language, as well as that of the German language in general. We hope to have provided a smooth and legible English text for English-speaking readers and students of the Third Reich history. This really is a priceless speech. It is well worth our efforts. She says, as editor, I added missing content where I believed it was suitable and reasonable to do so, and denoted these additions as such. For example, she used brackets in doing this. I also added some clarification words and phrases in instances where sentences did not make sense. It is possible that the stenographer missed words or phrases where he, presumably a man, was taking his notes. One final note, for those who wish to consult the original German text, you may request a copy of Hitler's 26 May 1944 Platterhoff speech from the Institute for Zeitgeschichte. Before I proceed to this speech, I would like to present, she's presenting an autobiography of Wilf Heinck. He gets to have his biography in there. Boy, you know, I don't think he even wants it in there, but there it is. Although he allowed it at that time. So I am hoping to get this speech myself Someone is going to try to order it for me. I don't know yet what it costs, but I have to find that out first and then go ahead and order it. And then I'll find out for myself just what this scan that they send you or this whatever it looks like and how much is missing and how it compares. And a couple of people have volunteered. One is a professional translator, is volunteered to translate it. So we'll eventually have our own copy here, just to find out what Ms. Clark did to this speech. And although, as Hattie Scott says, it's not important because there's nothing new in the speech. She was interested in it because she thought she could make out that there was some, that Hitler had changed all of his racial thinking, and this speech proved it. Well, it doesn't. And this is why I'd like to see the original and get a my own translation of it and make some comparisons just for this reason. I'm willing to do, you know, I mean, I don't mind at all doing this. I can't translate it myself. But I know that the translator I will be using is, and I don't put down Will Pike's translating ability at all, because he's translated things for me and he's perfectly capable of it. But you have to know the both languages quite well to really be a good translator. And this translator I would be using does. So therefore, we'll do that. And but now I'm going to go back to what Friedrich Berg wrote. And I'm convinced now from this that he didn't write this for this book. He wasn't writing a translation note for the book because, you know, he's not the translator. He's given a thanks as the last person here on this list of people being thanked. But also, she said that he is the one who got the speech, whatever form they have it in, from the Institute. He's the one who did that for her. He didn't pay for it, I don't suppose. She says she paid for it, but he did the paperwork and so on, or did the wrote to him and managed to get it, and. So that's probably his role at this point, because she only gives credit to Wilfred Hank for translating it, and she only talks about she and Wilfred working on the translation. Now, but what Friedrich Berg wrote in 2009, and he's not a professional translator, and he's I'm not putting down Fritz Berg's knowledge of German at all. He was born in the United States of German parents, and he obviously learned German in the home. You know, he grew up speaking German. So he's got that going. But he didn't live in Germany, grow up in Germany like most of the others have done. But that doesn't mean he's not a good translator. But he didn't translate this. But he's the one who's speaking here, who's been given this spot. And I think that he sent this to Veronica probably in answer to some questions of hers or just to help her out, giving his opinion of translations. He didn't write this for this book, and she thought it worked well for her, so she put it in the book. Who knows if she even asked him if she could, but he goes along with everything that she asks, so she very likely asked it, and he said, okay, that's all right. Anyway, here's what he writes. Oh, I need some water. Boy. He writes, translations are tricky. They can be lots of hard work, but they can also be a legitimate opportunity to enhance and clarify the meaning of the original text. What? Okay. They can be an opportunity to enhance and clarify the meaning of the original text. Why would you enhance the meaning of the original text? What does that mean anyway? You know, you're supposed to be following the original text, is the way I understand it, not improving on it. He says, Hitler's thoughts and writing in some instances are just not all that great. That can be said about everyone. So this is not an insult to Hitler. So my gosh, he's saying, well, Hitler's not such a great writer. So when you're translating him, you can make him sound better in the language that you're translating it into than it sounded in the original language. Seems to me that that's not the purpose. The purpose is to express exactly how the author wrote the original, only you have to allow for that you're using a different language with a different sentence structure. And so you have to rearrange some things. In some words, you can't translate exactly. There's no word for it, things like that. But otherwise, I don't get this. You're going to make the author sound better in your translation than he did in the original. That's what Fritz is saying there. So he says the trick for a really good translator is, first of all, to understand exactly and thoroughly what the author means or intends, even beyond the actual words and grammar of his text, and then see to it that the translation, and it's got that in quote marks, translation, shows the true meaning and intent even better than the original author's own words. Boy, I just have to shake my head at that. What's he talking about here? Maybe I'm all wet here. Maybe I haven't put this past a translator, but I think I understand enough to know that he's going a little too far here. He says a good translator has to understand exactly and thoroughly what the author means or intends. Well, how are you going to do that unless you can talk to him? If you can't talk to the author, you can't understand exactly and thoroughly what he meant or intended by what he said. All you have are the words, and you have to pass on what he actually said from one language to another as faithfully as you can. Because he says he adds to it that you're going to end up with your translation should be even better, should show the meaning and intent better than the original author's own words. So if the original author was not very able to express himself very well, then you in translating it are going to express him better than he was able to express himself. Is that what you're supposed to do? I don't think so. I wouldn't, particularly when you're dealing with world-famous people and what they, you know, trying to get exactly what they said, you're not going to take what Hitler said, his words that are taken down by the stenographer, and somehow give them a better meaning and show a better intent. That's the worst part. Show his intent better than he did himself, which means you can very easily be changing it. You probably will. I mean, you're messing around with the meaning of the words and the intent of the author when you do that. Woolley goes on to say, sometimes it is possible to do this, especially if the original text is not that great to begin with. Of course, one may cross a gray line between legitimate translating and rewriting, but if one is careful, one can still be honest about all of this. And if one is really clever, the translated text may convey the author's message in a new language far better than the author did in his original language. Well, he's saying, you know, this again in another way, but he's saying that you can, if you're clever, you can convey the author's meaning and the author's message better than he did. How do you have to know his meaning and his message? And if you're messing, if you think you do, and that's where this is ties in with Veronica Clark's idea that she knows better than Hitler what he thought and what his intent was. This is so clear that this kind of thing was going on, and that we're gonna show Hitler's meaning and intent better than he did, because he didn't do a very good job of getting it across in this speech. Wow. And Friedrichsberg says, something to think about. So look at the translations carefully to see if they can be improved for clarity, not just for accuracy. Well, there, I think he's giving some advice there in this missive he's written to Veronica. He's saying, when you get the translation, look carefully to see if it can be improved for clarity. Don't just look for accuracy, but look for clarity. Well, of course you want more clarity, but can the clarity come from thinking that you know better what the author's intent and meaning was? That's not clarity. That's it. That's where you know, where you have to know. It has to be clear what his intent was, and then you know you can tell in the German that it was. If the meaning and intent is there in the German, you have to find a way to express the same thing in English. But he seems to be turning it around and saying if the meaning and intent is not clear in the German, well then improve it so that it is clear in the English. Well, what's going to be clear? Something different? Because you don't know what the meaning and intent was. It's saying it's not clear. Well, I hope you follow that. I found this very, very interesting, and that's why then I thought, boy, I'm glad I've gone ahead with the request to get a copy of this speech, just to see what's going on with it. So now, there's a phone call. Okay. Hello there.
Oh, hello, Carolyn. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, great. Hello, I'm Eric. I was calling in to talk
Eric
about
Hunt.
Something. And, excuse me?
Eric Hunt?
No, Eric. Just Eric.
Oh, just Eric. Oh, okay. I'm glad I asked, because I was thinking, well, I didn't quite recognize the voice, but it could be him. All right, Eric.
Yeah, no. So I'm calling in about, just to give a counterpoint on what you're speaking on earlier with Facebook and everything. But before that, with this whole Veronica Clark thing, like, has it been actually confirmed that you could buy an original German translation of this speech? Has that been confirmed already?
No. No,
okay,
no. You have to do your own. You can buy the speech in German, if that's what you mean. You can buy the speech in German. Yeah, it's not a translation. It's the German.
There's an original that already exists, and it's available to be bought then. So that's already confirmed.
Well,
you're saying.
She bought it, so it's there at the Institute. If they have it, they usually sell those things. So I'm going to find out if I can buy it.
Now, here's the thing. I tried this a couple years ago, because as the same thing, the whole Planet Hawk speech is just so, you know, contradictory to the racial policies and belief. And it was obviously she was trying to make Hitler fit her own beliefs. And so I wanted to find this speech as well. And she said, you know, it was a German name, and I didn't understand it, where she got it from. So I copied and pasted that, and I put it in the search, and the Institute came up. So I wrote them, and I asked them, like, hey, can I get this speech, or do you guys sell speeches at least? And they said, no, we don't sell speeches. We never sold speeches. And that's where my search ended. I was like, okay, this is obviously something's going on here. So I was just wondering if you had it confirmed you can already get that German speech. Because when I tried and I went to the place that she said she got it from, they said they didn't, you know, sell speeches to people. So I was
were you
just wondering,
speaking to them in German? Were these German speaking people?
No, I wrote them in English, and they wrote me back in English.
Yeah, well, that could very well be. That's very well. That's very possible.
Yeah, but so this is why I'm curious when you're saying, which is great. If you can obtain that and translate that, that would be awesome. But, hey, I was just wondering if you had it already confirmed that you can do that because...
No, I don't.
Granted,
okay.
Okay,
no, I don't. But Veronica Clark herself gives out the number that she, the number of the speech at the Institute for Contemporary History there, and said that's what you ask for when you order it. But let's see.
I can't remember if I put a number or what it was. Like I said, this was years ago, but I just mm-hmm. know I fell short. And granted, I didn't do too much digging. Like after that, I was turned away from that. I just kind of gave up and, you know, figured it wasn't worth it. But it's, yeah, if you can, you know, confirm
well,
that
yeah,
you
well,
can get it
and stay tuned. And stay tuned to my website, or I'll probably mention it on a show. But I should find out next week. And,
oh, great.
What the answer is. And so just keep paying attention and you'll find out too.
Okay.
We'll
now, quickly, just to offer a counterpoint, which you're speaking about earlier, with Facebook,
uh-huh.
social media, movies, and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, it's like with watching movies and entertainment and all that, European people and just people in general, throughout history, before even Jews got involved in their cultures, you know, we enjoyed arts, entertainment, you know, it enhanced the imagination, creativity. So I understand why you would look at it completely, you know, negatively if an alleged white nationalist or someone who's against Jewish domination is, you know, watching Stanley Kubrick movies or something. But I don't know. I think it's kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater as, like, taking a more, like, we're going to remove ourselves from society and culture. When I think it's kind of opposite. We need to intertwine ourselves in the society and culture.
Yeah, you need to intertwine yourself. You need to intertwine yourself in a Jewish culture and a Jew-run society.
Because this is where we live in, Carolyn. This is we can deny it all we want and move away from society, but when we speak to everyone else, because the goal is to wake up more, because obviously who's already awakened isn't enough, like you're saying. There's a lot of bad qualities to a lot of the people attracted to this scene. And so, you know, obviously the goal is still reaching people, and if we can't speak a dialect that they understand, if we're completely removed from society, we don't know what's going on in social media, we don't know what's going on in pop culture. It's like, how can we communicate
with
people?
We don't not know what's going on. You have the internet. You can find out. I'm not involved in any of these things, and I know what's going on. And I can talk to
people. You look at it from outside.
I don't need to watch this. I don't need to be on Facebook. What?
What's that?
Go ahead.
Oh, no, but yeah, to an extent, you can look at stuff and get a general impression of it. But if you don't know, like I said, if you don't know what the youth are doing, because any change that's going to come in our society is going to come through our youth, whether we like it or not. The revolutionary mentality.
You know, Eric, I've heard all this stuff, I don't mean to cut you off, but I think you've made your point, and you've made my point, too, because this is what we run into. There's total resistance to not participating in every bit of this culture and every bit of what the Jews produce for us. And we like it, and you like it, and you're not going to give it up.
I do. I mean, it depends what you define as Jewish then. Like I said, arts and entertainment, I mean, I don't quite understand
Jewish
what you mean,
today.
What's Jewish and what's not. And
well, you don't know. You can't tell. So, okay, but you know what? I don't want to argue. I appreciate your call. I really do. And feel free to call in again. And feel free to write a comment to this program if you want to add some things.
Okay.
Okay. You have anything more that you want to bring up?
Alexander Dugin. It was my only knowledge of him is what I've read in the Fourth Political Theory. And have you read that book?
No.
Okay. You know, when he's speaking, it seems like there's a lot of double talk that comes off with what he's saying, because, like, he speaks mm-hmm. against racialism, but then he speaks of an ethnos. And then when you start looking into the ethnos, it's basically racialism, because it's saying a people that's a part of a land create the culture, and that should be preserved. And you know, cultures are created through the races of people. So, I mean, I don't quite know what he's really saying, but it seems like there's a lot of double talk into it. He calls himself the fourth position, but there's a lot of similarities to the third position. I think it's just innuendo and words that he's using that are more palatable to people to accept and not, you know, as soon as you hear fascism or racism or something, people will turn away automatically. So I'm not quite sure I would classify him as this anti-racist and completely bad for white cultures or white people. I do think he offers interesting ideas, but like I said, I think a lot of his ideas are very third position, and he's just rebranding the names and the definitions and terms.
Okay. Thanks very much, Eric, for those comments on my topics. Okay. I do appreciate it. And I'm sure you speak for many, many people. So
I'm not sure of that, but I don't know. I just think, like I said, I think the best propaganda is when we can speak commonly to the people. And I think we can obtain that when we can speak their verbiage. And I think removing ourselves from all awareness of that, we lose that. That was the only point I was trying to make.
Or speak
that
like...
The more Amish we become.
Okay. Oh, we don't want to be Amish. Okay. Thanks, Eric. Have a good day.
No problem. Thank you.
Thanks.
You as well.
Thanks. Bye-bye. I don't know. Did I hang up? I don't know how to hang up. Oh, there it went. All right. I hung up. I'm not used to getting phone calls here, you know. I'm not that swift at it. Well, I'm glad I got that call from Eric. But I think he got his message out there. All right. Now I'm going to go on to the other book by... with the Platterhouse speech in it, and again I'm on the Amazon page for this book, Hitler and Himmler Uncensored, and what it tells us about the page, well, about the book, is two hitherto unpublished top secret speeches of Hitler's and Himmler's, never before available in English until now. Of course, it's not true because. The Hitler speech came out, as we said, in December 2010, the Platterhouse speech, and this book is coming out 2012. So, but she has a note on the copyright page that, let's see here, on this one, on the copyright page, it says English translations copyrighted 2009-2012 by Veronica Clark and Wilfred Heinck. So this is what I was going by all along, that when she said complaint she wrote, she said that she was the sole copyright owner of this speech, the sole copyright of this translation of this speech. But now in the book, Hitler and Himmler Uncensored, it says that she and Wilfred Heinck hold the copyright. I guess she figured by then she needed to give him something. But now I was going by the fact that Wilfred Heinck is a translator and he even is shares in the copyright. So if he wants to send it to somebody and they want to do something with it, they have a right to. She's claiming that he doesn't hold the copyright, only she does. And I would never ask Wilf to contest any of this because he doesn't want to get involved and he doesn't want to do it and he's not interested in, he doesn't care about the speech anyway. He tells me he thinks it's not a very good speech, and he thinks he's the one who doubts whether it's authentic, because he says that Hitler is presenting himself, trying to present himself positively to the officers and generals, and he says he's already ruined himself with them because he's already made so many mistakes and blunders, and he had just fired Manstein, They wouldn't have believed a word he said. So he thinks that, he says, either Hitler's a fool or this speech never existed, never took place, or it took place at an earlier date. That's just his way of thinking, because he doesn't like this. He doesn't like the speech, and he's all, by this time, he's disenchanted with Hitler. So, but Veronica Clark just told him that he doesn't understand what she's trying to do. And he just went ahead and did what he promised to do. But this thing about reconciliation between Clark and Hank, that she said in a comment at John Friend's blog, Wilf and I have reconciled, and it's none of your business. Well, you know what? There's no reconciliation. They're just not going to be enemies, that's all. She apologized to him at some point not too long ago, and he accepted and said he doesn't hold any grudges, and okay, fine, I'm not mad at you, I'm not mad at you, and they left it at that. But that's what's called reconciliation. There's not going to be any more work between Wilf and Veronica. I'm pretty sure about that. There's not going to be any more associations, and that's why she's trying to learn how to learn German and learn how to do it all herself. Because I don't think that Fritz Berg is going to do all that translation work for her. And he may not be quite, he just may not have the interest in doing it. That's very time consuming. It's a lot of hard work. So on this, I want to get rid of this. Oh, heck. That's not what I want. Oh, I've got the same thing. Well, I guess I didn't go there. All right. I don't need to go there. So then I found another book, another recent book by Clark. She's got so many books. And I think this is a kind of an under-the-radar book or something. It only comes out, well, it's in paperback. I guess they all are. It's called Managing Our Perceptions of the Third Reich and Historiographical Challenge. So, you know, here again, this really shows, this was came out in March 24th, 2013. This really shows what she's trying to do. She's saying that other people are managing our perceptions of the Third Reich, and she is trying to show the truth about the Third Reich, but it's interesting that she uses those words. You know, she wants to be a, I don't have much time here, so I'll continue with this. She says, this study dovetails with our latest two Power Wolf publications, The Controversy of Black Nazis 2 and The Other Nazis. That's another book, The Other Nazis. Excerpt, there is someone out there who doesn't want you to read this. In fact, they are so opposed to your reading this material that they have tried and are still trying to get this material banned from Amazon.com and other booksellers. American university professors such as Ethan B. Katz, Randall Bitwork, and my former thesis advisor, Dr. Mike Wadiko, are among an active and growing network of professional censors. So her former thesis advisor is against her. And Katz would be a Jew. Randall Bitwork is the one who's put together that Third Reich archive, wonderful site that has all kinds of material translated that he gives people for free. You know, he doesn't, he has a couple books he's written, but he offers all those translations of Third Reich material that he's done for free, knowing, has to know that a lot of people who like it appreciate that, not just the people who want to use it as an example of something bad, but also her, and then her own, but her own thesis advisor, I mentioned it. So, I was going to say, I think these people, I don't know if they're trying to censor her work, but if they don't like it, it's because it's not very good. It's because it's not good. If Randall Bitwork doesn't like it. It's because he's an academic, and he thinks that what she's doing is just not up to par for, and she's not telling the truth. So they certainly don't see Adolf Hitler as an anti-racist like she does, and they're right about that. But Clark goes on to, you know, she says, they intimidate, ridicule, slander, lie, plant rumors, and even threaten writers who disseminate this material. And then she says, she's always complaining about those who don't accept what she does and saying that's because, you know, they're either nasty people or they don't want her truth to come out or they don't want to allow a different point of view or whatever. So she's always doing that. Boy, I got a bunch here I didn't get to. I'm not going to get to it. Let's see if there's anything in here that's really important. Let's see if I can pull this together. I'm not going to go on over the 2 hours. So here's a comment on John Friend's blog from this last show that he had with Veronica, and I wanted to comment on this. It's kind of like Eric who called in. He's not quite the same. He's had it said something different, but this one says, let me get off this page. Get rid of this. This one says, on August 15th, he wrote, reading through all of this, he means all the comments to the program, I forgot who our real enemy is. These days, whichever alternative truth site I visit, they all seem to be full of name-calling and infighting. Our masters, in quotes, must be very proud of us. They are unified, focused, and determined. We are a rabble. Well, this kind of sums up the program today, because if we're not getting anywhere with our truth, is it because we have any infighting? Because we have some infighting? Well, to me, this person doesn't understand that the enemy is in our ranks. It's even calling disagreement infighting, something our masters never do. Well, they do disagree. Even among Jews, there's lots of disagreement, but they have a plan, I guess, maybe. But our certain disagreements are bound to happen, and within our group, we should be able to talk about them and have a little infighting going on. But sometimes the difference is so strong and so powerful. You can't bring it together. There's no way for what my point of view and Veronica Clark's point of view to ever come together. So there's no use in trying to do that, considering yourself as part of the same group, as part of the same program that you're trying to do. So I'm going to have to say goodbye for now, ladies and gentlemen, and find my closeout music and say thanks for listening today. It's Saturday afternoon with Carolyn on August 16th, 2014. Bye for now.